This is Cam.
And I'm Jen.
And you're listening to
Our True Crime Podcast.
This is Edward October, and I'm here with my friend, Rollo, the Devil Doll. You see, I must explain. Like all demonic ventriloquist dummies, Rollo has a problem with swearing. Rollo, stop it. We're here to tell everyone that Our True Crime Podcast may not be appropriate for all listeners.
Because they're so filthy!
Rollo, it's not that. Jen and Cam would like us to remind everyone that they discuss subject matter that may be disturbing to some listeners, especially children.
God, f*** your mother!
Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Heather.
And I'm Rochelle.
And
we're the hosts of Nature vs. Narcissism, a true crime podcast mixed with some dark humor.
Sometimes we have alcohol.
Sometimes we have guests.
Sacramento, California.
Canton, Michigan.
Green River,
Honolulu,
Washington.
Hawaii.
Omaha, Nebraska.
Niagara, North Dakota.
Gloucester, United Kingdom.
Dakota County, Wyoming.
Epazoyucan, Hidalgo, Mexico.
Flint, Michigan.
Boston, Massachusetts.
Phoenix, Arizona.
Woodruff, South Carolina.
Todmorden, Yorkshire.
Hudson Valley, New York. In Season 2, we will examine notorious killers in cities across the globe from A to Z.
We'll delve into their criminal history as well as their upbringing to try to determine why these killers commit these violent acts.
Was it nature?
Was it nurture?
Or was it plain old narcissism?
Find us on your favorite podcast streaming service.
Or visit murder.ly.
Norway reeling from twin attacks. First, a suspected car bomb.
Thomas Quick was known as Sweden's worst serial killer. Quick was convicted.
Kim Wall disappeared after boarding Madsen's submarine in Copenhagen Harbour last August.
Terrorism, miscarriages of justice, serial killers, disappearances. From the known to the lesser known, we give you true crime from the dark and frozen regions of Northern Europe. This is Nordic True Crime. Subscribe to our bi-weekly episodes on iTunes, Spotify, or on your podcast provider. And find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Nordic True Crime.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. What's going on?
We have our winners for our t-shirt contest.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Exactly. Okay. We will be announcing the winners.
Winner, winner, t-shirt winner.
Winner.
We're going to make everybody wait a little bit, get a listen to our show before you get to find out if you're a winner.
We will announce the winners after the show, right?
Exactly.
To tell you the truth, we had so many people put in a caption. We were actually really impressed. We were shocked.
Very. So much so, we couldn't pick a winner.
We couldn't. So basically what we did is everybody that entered, every time you entered, we put your name in a hat and we're going to draw out 10 names. You guys are really pretty funny.
Really funny.
And not just funny looking like Camille. You guys are like funny, funny.
Very funny.
We appreciate it.
So it was hard. Jen would like one and then I'd like one. And then we're looking at, 35 winners.
Yeah.
So. All right, Jen, so you got a case. Since we're going to make all the good people wait, what are we going to hear about today?
Well, Valentine's Day is tomorrow, and this isn't really Valentine's related. But
Valentine's?
Valentine's. But it is...
All little kids say Valentine's.
And they do. But it is... It's called the Sweetheart Murders, mm-hmm. and it happened in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because it took 32 years... to solve.
Ooh.
And it actually uses all the stages of DNA, which is kind of neat.
Oh,
kind of
cool.
Fun.
Very
right?
Cool.
You ready?
I am so ready.
All right. In the summer of 1980, Sabrina Gonsalves was 18 years old, and she was moving into an apartment with her older sister, Andrea. Now, Sabrina was about to go to college at University of California in Davis, and Andrea was already
Davis.
UCD. Mm-hmm. She moved into an apartment with her sister, Andrea, who was already attending the college. And Sabrina was very excited to start there in the fall and start her new life. Andrea said about Sabrina that she was extremely innocent. She was very sweet.
Yeah, sure.
She was very sweet and she was very fun to be around. She loved kids and animals, especially horses. And she had an aspiration to work with kids in special needs. That was going to be her career. Sabrina got a job working at Davis Recreation Center. And that's where she met John Riggins. John Riggins was also 18 and he was also about to start at UC Davis in the fall. He was cute. He had red hair and he was an athlete, very smart. He wanted to be an engineer and make artificial limbs, prosthetics.
It's way cool.
He was your star athlete in high school. Everybody loved him. Very sweet. They hit it off and they started dating. And it was puppy love. Actually, Sabrina's sister said that it was Sabrina's first real boyfriend and they totally were infatuated. As far as good kids go, these were like the cream of the crop, good kids.
Aww.
There was nobody gooder than these two. They were good students, perfect couple. They were very involved with their community service and volunteering and all sorts of stuff. On December 20th, 1980, that right before Christmas, John and Sabrina had volunteered to be ushers at a children's performance of The Nutcracker. They had left in the Riggins family van, which was your classic late 70s two-tone van. Like when you think of California in the early 80s, that's the van that you see. And this is the van it was. So it was a 1977 Chevrolet two-tone van. They were going to go to a surprise party for Sabrina's sister, Andrea. She was going to be 22. People at the party waited all night. Ooh. They never showed up.
Oh.
And they never called. The next morning when Sabrina still hadn't come home, her sister knew that something was weird because they were very close. They always knew where one or the other would be at all times. And she had seen, when she had got home that night, she had seen that the stuff that Sabrina was supposed to be at the party, was supposed to bring to her birthday party, was there or was gone. The ice cream she was supposed to bring, the cookies she was supposed to bring, everything was gone. Sabrina's dog was still at the apartment. And also Sabrina's wallet was at the apartment.
So the food was gone, but her wallet was still there?
The food was gone, the dog and the wallet was still there. Just Andrea knew something was wrong, and so she immediately called the police and made a missing persons report. John's parents started to worry also because the night before had been extremely foggy, and they were scared to death that there'd been a horrible accident. So they started to drive around searching in the area. They went and looked at ditches. The police started searching for the two kids. At the time, Davis only had, like, I think, 36,000 people, roughly, and it was very...
Most of it's college kids.
They said it was very Mayberry-ish around that time. When the police started looking, they also put out a story on the news. 36 hours later, the police located the van, and it's found under a tree about 30 miles east of Davis, and the keys were locked inside of it. And the inside of the van was completely trashed. The gifts intended for Andrea, totally ripped open. Stuff that was in the boxes were thrown.
So somebody went
the van.
It.
Somebody went through it.
I got you.
And one of the gifts was a red and blue blanket because Andrea had always claimed to be cold. This was one of the things that was opened up and it was put across one of the van seats. The van, the keys, everything else was there except for the couple. So the police still had hope that maybe there was some kind of accident or something was wrong with the car, and they set off on foot. Detectives started looking around the area, and not far from where the van was, there was this field. So they started checking out the field, and a few hours later, one of the detectives spotted a boot. When he walked down the 7-foot-deep, heavily wooded ravine, he found Sabrina's body, face down, and her skirt was pulled up. A few feet away, he found John. He was lying on his back. One of the detectives at the scene said the horrificness of what we were seeing and what they must have gone through, they were dumped just like trash. This ravine actually was a place that the police knew about, and it had this reputation of a lot of drug activities had gone on and a lot of stolen cars were dumped in this ravine. So the police kind of suspected that the killer or killers were from around the area. Mm-hmm. So later the pathologist would note that John Riggins had multiple trauma to his head and neck. There was a reddish mark that suggested some sort of ligature had been wrapped around his neck. On the left side of John's neck, there was also fingernail marks that were consistent of John trying to free himself of what was wrapped around his neck. He'd also been struck in the head with a blunt object, and the pathologist stated that he thought it was possible that John was fighting for his and Sabrina's life, and that caused the killer to hit him over the head to render him unconscious. Mm-hmm. Pathologist stated that the cause of John's death was a 4-inch-long cut to his throat that missed his jugular vein. And he aspirated on his own blood and said that it's most likely he would have survived if he would have been found earlier. He slowly bled out and basically drowned in his own blood. Sabrina had duct taped Rhett completely around her head in the fashion of a mummy. Like,
so her whole face was
her
covered?
Her whole face was covered, but only a little area was left open under her nose. And they said it did allow air in, but not much. And her breathing still would be restricted. And he said this because he noticed the petechial hemorrhaging around her eyes and ears, saying it was consistent with asphyxiation. There was also a faint ligature mark on one side of her neck, but the pathologist couldn't say if it was made before or after she died. Sabrina's cause of death was a 4-inch wide, 2-inch deep cut that sliced through her jugular vein. And there was also a major cut that perforated her larynx. There was also 4 other cuts, but they were just superficial. Both John and Sabrina had been bound around the wrist and ankles with duct tape, but it had appeared to that the duct tape had been cut prior to their bodies being dumped.
So they were taped up by the perpetrators and then taken down there and then the cut?
Cut. The pathologist noted that Sabrina had superficial abrasions and roughening to her vaginal area, which could be a sign of sexual assault. And remember, this is in the 80s, right? It also could be a sign of post-mortem activity. He said that the swabs he took yielded no signs of sperm.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's post-mortem? What are we thinking here?
Could have been damaged when body was thrown. Could have.
Okay, that's not what I was thinking.
Right,
okay.
Exactly. Same. In the 1980s, the swabs he took yielded no sign of sperm. But years later, would show otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Police were now thinking that they had a serial killer on the loose. One said, you know, when you cut somebody's throat with a knife, you either have to be pretty desperate or you have to be pretty cold-blooded. He also said the suspect did have some planning. He came there with a sharp knife or some other weapon, and he had the duct tape with him.
I'm wondering why he cut it. Like, why would he cut that? Did to walk down there? Like, were their legs taped? And he cut that so that they could walk, but why would you do their hands? And then if you did it prior, if you did it prior to killing them, what's the point? Because then they could hurt you. And then why would you cut it after you kill them?
I don't know.
That makes no sense. Okay, go ahead.
They never came back to say why.
They didn't?
No.
That doesn't make any sense.
No.
Well, I mean, I could see the legs, maybe to force them to walk at gunpoint or whatever.
The police surmised that Sabrina and John had gone back to the apartment because they had gotten all the things for the party. And they had either been kidnapped just after they left the apartment or the apartment complex. They knew it happened before they got to a main road. But that's since there was no witnesses or anything, that's the only thing that they could suspect. So tips came pouring in, and there was even a composite sketch made of a mysterious man that had been seen around the area. So there are 2 theories. One was that it was a cult killing. This theory came about because the murder happened during a winter solstice.
Oh.
And the people thought, because it was so bloody, that it was a ritual sacrifice. And the other was a copycat killer. Now, you'll remember this, 12 Nightmares Before Christmas.
Ooh.
Night 10.
Yeah. Which one?
The episode 10.
No, but they think that
it was a copycat killer.
Oh.
48 days before Sabrina and John went missing, Craig Miller and Mary Beth Sower were college students that were abducted in Sacramento on November 2nd, 1980. Their bodies were found later. They had been killed execution style, but their murder had already been solved. The killer was Gerald Gallego. Remember the sex slave killer?
Gallego, isn't it?
Gallego. But here's the thing. He was already in jail for the crime, but the police had a theory that Gallego had talked some family or friends into killing Sabrina and John to try to clear him of...
Throw people off, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And they liked mm-hmm. to kill... They did kill a few couples trying to get to the girl.
Right, they could never find anything to prove this theory. 6 years later, Davis police detectives revisited this Gallegos Hunt conspiracy because it seems David Hunt, which is Gallegos' half-brother, had been in Carson City getting married to Sue Ellen May Shirley on December 20th, 1980. This would have given them time to get to Davis and pull off the crime, the murder, after meeting up with an accomplice, Richard Thompson, and then still get to Carson City Motel 6, where they checked out of the next day. When they interviewed David Hunt, he lied, and he said that they had actually gotten married in Las Vegas.
Like, that's not trackable.
I know. So that made it, you know, logistically impossible for them to get to Davis in the time frame. The police thought, well, they're hiding something, right? Have to be hiding something. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, the police get a call from a police informant that had been working with him. And that informant was named Ray Gonzalez. And he had been looking through the paper and he saw the police sketch. He thought it was a match to David Hunt because they were childhood friends. And, you know, David had grown up to be a criminal. November 1989,
oh,
were families of these two kids. The police had spent thousands and thousands of hours on this theory, which they dubbed the Hunt Group, which was David Hunt, the half-brother, Sue Ellen Hunt, David's wife, Gallegos' friends Richard Thompson and Doug Lanier. They finally arrested them, the four. They were charged with murdering Sabrina and John. And if convicted, they would get the death penalty. Now, remember, they had all these coincidences and no really strong evidence. They arrested him on circumstantial evidence.
And it was light. It was...
For 3 years, these people were in prison. And they maintained Before trial.
Wow.
And I don't know why it took so long. I never found anything why it took so long to get them to trial. Probably because the police were trying to look for evidence, mm-hmm. I would assume.
They'd probably... Strong evidence. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They always maintained their innocence, all four of them. They're like, we didn't do it. And a couple of them, David Hunt, one, and the other one, Doug Lanier, they're like, you know, they made us out to be these masterminds, and we're not. You know, they thought, he's like, we're just petty thefts. And Doug Lanier said, I'm just a dumb little criminal. And he's like, what I was doing was dumb little criminal things. And he said those dumb things was like stealing bed sheets from hotels. But they weren't murderers. They were just in 1992.
Holy moly.
They're getting ready for trial. And the Hunt Group's defense attorney decided, you know, we're going to go and we're going to look through everything in the van to see if there's anything mm-hmm. we can do.
12 years later.
12 mm-hmm. years later. There's this new thing called DNA. They're like, maybe there's something we can do. We can test these things out for DNA. Well, they looked at the blanket that Sabrina had bought for Andrea. The criminologist in 1980, he said he couldn't find anything that would even be considered evidence. Like, he looked at it and there was nothing.
That's weird, though. Like a hair, a fiber, there had to be something on it. No. Okay.
They did find a hair on John's sweater, mm-hmm. but they said it looked consistent to David Hunt's hair. But they didn't have the technology at the time mm-hmm. to say anything, to say that, yes, that is his hair. The criminologist in 1980, he looked at the blanket at the time, but he didn't have anything that they considered evidence what it would be. And nobody really thought it was a key piece, so they had just put it back.
Thank goodness they kept it.
At one point, the California Department of Justice criminalist Faye Springer was conducting a routine review of the evidence of the case. And there she discovered 4 semen stains on the blanket from the...
Which was a brand new blanket.
Brand new blanket mm-hmm. that was found in the Riggins van. Then the defense requested to have the DNA sent to a private lab because none of the places at the time had their own labs. At this time, DNA was only able to prove that you did not do it. And this is important for later. There was also a oral swab taken from Sabrina, her throat.
Oh.
And at the time did not show anything, but later found to have sperm. And then in January 93, when the DNA came back, the lawyer... Go ahead.
Even in the 80s, couldn't you tell what's... Like, how did they not know that was sperm? I mean, there's like a chemical that...
Well, there was some kind of original... A dye that malfunctioned or didn't... There was something to do with the dye that they had used. Mm. And I'm not quite for sure. But I'll give... If people are really interested, I'll give where I found the information.
That's fine. I'm just curious. Like,
yeah. In January of 93, the lawyer for David Hunt told him that they're going to need a DNA sample. He warned them that if he did commit the murders, or if he had any knowledge of the murders, if he was involved in any way, do not let them take a DNA sample, because it would put him for certain on death row.
Mm-hmm. But if he didn't do it, why would you not do that?
Exactly. David Hunt couldn't wait to give his sample.
Okay, good.
And he said once they did everything they needed to do and he gave them what they needed, he was dancing down the hall because he knew
he didn't do it.
That his time would be done. It was the eve of the trial for the Hunt group that the county prosecutors were forced to dismiss the charges.
Wow.
The testing showed that the semen stains did not match John Riggins or any of the three males that were in the Hunt group. So the case is cold again. The family of John and Sabrina's parents were devastated because here they thought after 13 years we're finally going to get closure. And now it just stopped. And the Riggins family had even moved out of the town because Dr. Riggins, John's father, he was an orthopedic surgeon. He said he just couldn't stand all the memories. When he would go to the hospital to work every morning, he would pass the morgue every day. And he's like, it was just too much for me.
Yeah.
So now we're going to the summer of 2002.
Ooh.
Former newspaper journalist Joel Davis, he began working on a book about this case.
Hmm.
He had known John Riggins when they were younger, or known of him. He was a couple years younger at school, and he was from around the same area. It always bothered him that the case had never been solved. He's writing this book, and it starts to generate interest again. Now, in 2002, DNA has gotten a little bit better. The Sacramento County authorities start to process the DNA again. When the results came back, they found two sets of DNA profiles that were mingled together on the blanket. One was Sabrina's, and the other one was an unknown subject. So they run it through CODIS, the national database, and they get a hit.
Yay!
It's a 1 in 240 trillion match.
Wow.
It's a sexual deviant by the name of Richard Joseph Hirschfield. When that came back, they're like, who?
Yeah.
We have no idea who this is. You know, why?
Had he been in trouble before? You said sexual deviant.
Oh, yeah. He's, but he was unknown to any of the police in the area. And this is where the CODIS really big deal. If they would have ran this in 92, it would have only searched for people in that area.
Mm.
But he was serving time for a child molestation in Washington State. So CODIS was able to find him in Washington, and they were able to get him that way. So since no one had heard of him, the police started to look into him, and they discovered that Hirschfield did have a connection to the Davis area. In April 1975, however many months before Sabrina and John were killed, Hirschfield had committed a rape and robbery. Basically, it wasn't very far from John and Sabrina's apartment, or from where Sabrina had an apartment. Later at the trial, the victim of this crime was able to take the stand and discuss the horrible person he was. She recounts it as, there was a guy standing there with a gun in his hand and a nylon stocking over his head. She was 22 at the time. He demanded bread, which is slang. I know we don't like to use slang, but this is for the case. He demanded bread, which is slang for money. And he said he wasn't going to hurt us if we did what he told us to do.
Mm-hmm.
She said the man used rope and a box cutter to tie up the three victims, which was her sister, who was 16, and her boyfriend at the time.
Yeah, that's pretty brave of him to encounter three people and take them on, right?
Mm-hmm. Breaking into the house. And her sister screamed the minute he touched her. After he got everybody tied up, he said, okay, who wants to be raped? The woman's like, I couldn't let him hurt my sister, so I said I'd do it. He took her and moved to another room, and he raped her. And then afterward, the man went through the cabinets and purses and drawers. Then he undressed the women, cut the phone lines, and then he left.
Why did he undress the women?
I don't know. The woman said she then went to a neighbor's apartment and called the police. About a week later, an off-duty police officer recognized Hirschfield because he had on this green jacket that was mentioned in the police bulletin. He was arrested, and in his car, the police officer said the police discovered a rope, a box cutter, nylon stockings,
his kill kit,
a garrote, and a .38 caliber revolver with a homemade silencer. He was then sentenced to 7 years to life, and was eligible for parole in 5 years. During that time, he was able to con his way out of prison, and he was released in June 1980.
Mm.
And when this happened, Hirschfield was 6 foot tall, 240 pounds, and he was about 31 years old. Hirschfeld was pretty much a drifter. The authorities thought maybe he was in Sabrina's apartment complex when he saw her and had his eye on her and would come back for her. And actually, Joel Davis, the person, the guy that was writing a book, he actually said that Sabrina's sister, Andrea, had told him that on one occasion in the 80s, a man was in the parking lot and waved a tool around at the around the condo, and Sabrina's German Shepherd was like lunging at him.
Ooh.
So that could have been him. While they were looking into him, they found that he was also extremely, extremely smart. Like, they called him Unabomber smart.
Really?
He had gone to a private school, and his schoolmates, his classmates, said that he was either going to be the president of NASA or he was going to be a world-class serial killer.
No.
That he was going to be a big criminal. Mm. At the time of, you know, the DNA match, he was actually in prison in Washington State for child rape. That's what put his genetic profile into the DNA base.
That's how they found him.
His conviction was actually, this is how smart he was. He played the system. His conviction was overturned in 2005 because he wanted to be his own attorney. And then he changed his mind about being his attorney. And then
dragging it out.
He drug it all out. And then finally, his conviction was overturned on appeal because he was denied the request to act his own attorney. So he did, he liked to play. And you will find that out when it comes to this trial too. He was actually in prison for the molestation of two little girls in 1996. One was age 9, one was 11, and it was at a water park. Mm. He had touched them underneath their bathing suit. So on November 19th, 2000...
They were sisters or friends?
What, the two little girls?
Uh-huh.
Didn't say.
Oh, okay.
They just said two little girls, 9 and 11. Hmm. To find out more information about Richard Hirschfeld, they wanted to talk to his family. Two Sacramento detectives went to his brother Joe's place in Oregon, and then two others went to talk to Hirschfeld in the prison in Washington State. They just wanted to make sure that no phone calls would be made afterwards to get their stories together. So Joe Hirschfeld was a mechanic, and he was at his job when the police went to talk to him. The detectives asked Joe if he remembered where his brother was at the time the murders happened.
Wow.
You know, they were just wondering because they had DNA for these murders and they were just going to arrest him, but they just wanted to know. Really didn't say much. And
I don't know how you would remember that far away.
I couldn't. I can't even remember what I did last week.
Unless they did, unless something happened. Murder. Yeah.
Nothing much was said because, you know, they only wanted information of Richard. They didn't care much about Joe. And so they didn't talk very long. But later, Joe's wife said that he had come home.
Joe did?
Joe had come home early, and it was not like him to come home. And she also said that he was upset, and he was very red-faced, she recalled. He immediately poured himself a glass of whiskey, another, which was also weird, because he only drank a couple nights a week. And then at one point during the night, he and his wife started talking about the detective's visit. And she had asked him if he was involved in the crime, and questions along that line. She said that Joe had told her that he wasn't involved, and she said at the time she was really relieved, because it would disrupt our lives quite a bit.
I'd say so.
Really? Thanks, Captain Obvious. The next day, it was just as went as planned. Joe said goodbye to his wife, not once but twice. Told her how much he loved her both times.
Mm-hmm.
Never came home. When he was gone, still gone the next morning, she knew that something was wrong, right? Soon after, she went out to the couple's barn and to feed the farm animals, and she heard music coming from a metal structure out in her field. And she noticed that there was a dirty film covering the windows of Joe's car was out in the field, and there was a dirty film covering the windows of his car. And when she looked in, he was inside dead.
Mm-hmm.
He died from carbon monoxide poisoning. Mm. He was reclined in the driver's seat with a 2-page note written on legal pad at his side. And the note said, "I have been living with this horror for over 20 years. I was there. My DNA is there. I am so sorry, but it's in the past. And I wanted to tell you last night, but I couldn't bear to see the hurt on your face." Well, upon the investigation, Joe was living in a mobile home park in the winter of 1980, which was about less than 10 miles from where John and Sabrina's bodies were dumped. the police had said, you know, it's kind of funny because when we were talking to his wife about the DNA, she said she had always watched crime shows and Joe never paid much attention. But, you know, he'd come in from working on a car and she'd go, oh, they just got this guy. They got his DNA. And once they get your DNA, it's over, man. It's over. Right. So they think that that put it in his head, knowing he thought his DNA was there and he was going to get in trouble.
It wasn't,
too.
Though.
It wasn't.
Yet.
Joe had a vasectomy. And so there was no way that his DNA was nowhere on the crime scene. It was never found on the crime scene.
Mm-hmm. He had a DNA by at that time in 1980?
He had had a vasectomy at the time of in the 1980s.
Okay.
So he.
So Joe could.
There was no DNA. Okay. They never found any DNA of Joe on the scene
Just
at all.
Just Richard.
Just Richard.
Okay.
The police don't even know what part Joe played in it at all because they cannot place him at the crime scene at all. So he had just heard his wife say so many times that the DNA was there that he just thought.
But he was there, right?
They don't know. They assume it was. He said that he.
Well, see, that would make sense when I said that it seems weird that the guy would take on multiple people. So maybe he did.
But he did the first time in 1975.
Or maybe he did. Maybe they just, he didn't want to admit it more. I don't know. Okay, go ahead.
The note later during the trial, Joe's ex-wife, which was a totally different person than the first one, would later testify that Richard was always the leader of the two and he would always bully Joe. And Richard was very dominant and intelligent, whereas Joe was kind of meek and very quiet. But she did overhear this weird conversation about this restaurant called Rudy's Hideaway, which is a very popular restaurant that was not too far from where the Riggins van was found. It seemed that Richard was always needling Joe, you know, don't you think we should take Bobby to Rudy's Hideaway? Maybe we should take her with us the next time. Joe would always act very nervous and fidget every time that was
Bobby is
talked about. Bobby was the ex-wife. Yeah. She just chalked it up as teasing each other. And
but you can see that he's doing that to bring that up to, yeah.
To make, he was very nervous when Richard brought that up. Joe was nervous
but
when Richard
was doing that to be.
Right. You know, after that happened, Rudy's Hideaway was never mentioned again. So September of 2004, Hirschfield was extradited to California, where he was charged with 2 counts of first degree murder with 4 special circumstances alleging multiple murders and murder in the commission of kidnapping, rape and oral copulation, because remember they found the swab. The prosecutors are going to see the death penalty for this. After 8 years, this is how smart this man is. 2012, they're finally going to trial.
2012?
2012.
From a 1980 murder?
From a 1980 murder where the guy was in custody from 2004.
Wow.
For 8 years, he was in custody. And he was that smart. One resources that I had found said that he would play stuff like he would be pointing to his name that was on the arrest warrant. He's like, this isn't me. You can't prove it's me. And the reason why he said that was his name was in all caps. So he's like, that's not really my name because it's in all caps. So he was
like he just
working
played the game.
Yeah. Yep. He was playing. So it took 8 years to get him to trial.
That's insane.
The case had over 200,000 pages of discovery and Hirschfield's defense team would file about 200 motions. And they were granted, so that caused a lot of the delays. Here comes the trial. The defense brought in a former high school football teammate that Richard knew, and his name was, and he testified saying that Hirschfield came to his home, and they were just saying, hey, what's going on, and all this kind of stuff. And Hirschfield had told him that he had just got out of prison. He had been caught having bomb-making materials and a silencer.
He left out a few key details there.
Well, yeah. And then before long, the conversation took a weird turn where Hirschfield said, yeah, if they had gotten me for what I'd really did, I'd still be in there. Then when he asked Hirschfield, well, you know, what is that? He said, you know, if I told you that, I'd have to kill you. Right? Most people say that, right? Joking around. And so his friend said, yeah, I just kind of left it there. I didn't want to go into any more detail. They're like, oh, you know, are you sure that he was serious? And he's like, oh, yeah, he was serious. He was. Hirschfield didn't really give him the whole story. This was he just got out of prison because of the sexual assault and the robbery at the Mountain View apartments. Hirschfield's defense attorney was still going after the Hunt group, even though
his DNA was found and theirs wasn't.
Okay. Right. And the DNA, they said that, well, Richard Hirschfield was a transient and he just happened to come upon this van. He slept in the van and just happened to masturbate and
the blanket. Yep.
Spilled a seed all over the blanket. It was too much of a coincidence that it was mixed up with Sabrina's DNA also.
Yeah. Those two are found dead nearby.
Okay. Yeah. In California law, you're able to bring in past witnesses, or you're able to bring, I forgot how this goes.
You can bring in
their past crimes.
There you go.
Into play. They were able to bring in the two kids that he molested at the pool. They were able to bring woman that he raped. November 5th, the jury deliberates for over 3 hours, which could be good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
They come back and they convict Hirschfeld of kidnapping, 2 counts of murder, and a count of oral copulation. So this now goes to the penalty phase of a trial.
Mm-hmm.
They have to figure out if he's going to get life in prison,
mm-hmm,
without a chance of parole, or the death penalty case. Judge calls for the penalty court to be held on November 26th. Dr. Richard Riggins, Joe's dad, Dr. Richard Riggins gets on the stand and he testified that he has never been able to forgive himself for failing to protect his 18-year-old son, who, along with Sabrina Gonzalez, he says that visualizing the way he died, his head wrapped in tape, his throat cut, trying to get air from himself from the wound in his neck, you know he's dying, and I wasn't there. I failed in my biggest duty to him, Riggins testified. I feel very guilty about that. I know it's irrational, but there's that basic duty of getting your child into adult life, and I didn't do that.
Heartbreaking.
Andrea, Sabrina's sister, said, I'm physically sickened and enraged when I think of the terror, pain, and horror they must have felt as they died in a ditch. And then, of course, the defense gets their say, and they called in a clinical psychologist, and they stated that Hirschfeld, who was now 63 years old, when he was younger, he lived in a constant state of terror. He was born to a 15-year-old mother who had been impregnated by her stepfather, was subjected to further abuse during the course of their relationship, and wished he had 5 more kids.
Mm. All by the stepfather?
All by the stepfather. The psychologist that was brought in based her testimony on 4 reports that she had read, including interviews with Hirschfeld's mother and youngest brother. And the reports painted a picture that Hirschfeld's father subjected his mother to sexual and emotional abuse. And she said that this was transmitted to Hirschfeld, and it was a subject, and it subjected him to trauma. You know, the prosecuting attorney said, you know what, he's got 4 other or 5 other brothers and sisters, and none of them had any problems. Although with Joe, supposedly there were allegations, but nothing ever came of those allegations.
And obviously, he had some issues too.
Right. And then another defense witness came to play and said that he had studied MRIs of Hirschfeld's brain.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that they were very abnormal scans, and that constitutes to brain damage. And he said this is a serious brain abnormality in the area of the brain that's involved with emotional processing and control over the behavior. So the prosecution says, okay, so you're not saying that he can't exercise free will. And the doctor's like, no, I'm not saying that. And the prosecution said, not saying that he's not capable of making decisions about what's right and what's wrong. Doctor's like, I'm not saying that either. Prosecution said, so you're not saying that he's mentally ill, correct? And he says, nope, I'm not saying that either.
Mm-hmm.
He's just saying that they're trying to get reasonable doubt.
Right. And lots of people have brain damage.
Exactly.
Doesn't make him a killer.
You're not a killer. Look at how much brain damage
thanks,
you have.
Jim.
So on December 6th, the jury comes back and recommends the death sentence. And Judge Michael Sweet handed down the sentence to Richard Hirschfeld, who was 63 now. And Sweet said that the evidence showed Hirschfeld displayed a high degree of cruelty and callous disregard for human life.
Mm-hmm.
Later, the judge said directly to Sabrina and John's family, 32 years after the murders, that you have endured so much. The tortured history of this case must have taken away any hope that you had that the person responsible for these acts would be discovered and held to answer. My sincere and deep felt apologies for these tragedies you have suffered. But as of now, Richard Hirschfeld is currently on death row in San Quentin.
Ugh, he's still alive?
And he's appealing his conviction.
San Quentin? Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if Earlon Woods knows him.
Hmm. I don't know. We could ask.
Gary Russell.
Yeah, that but might. Was he on death row? He wasn't on death row.
No, he's not on death row.
I think they keep death
they
row
do.
People
they keep them separate.
Separate.
But you would know, like, I would think that the word would get
I don't know.
Around.
I mean, it's amazing how many people do not know.
That they're in there?
No, about this murder. I don't know.
I don't know either. Well, good. I hope he rots.
I do too.
Just saying.
I don't know.
And you know what? That's what we know about. You know he did more stuff. I always say that, but it's true.
Oh, yeah.
You don't just kill 2 people and then quit for 32 years. You kidding me?
Oh, and also listen to a podcast that's done out of Sacramento and it, to the podcast, but it's done by the criminal justice. It's done by the district attorneys of Sacramento County.
Oh, cool.
And it had the prosecuting attorney mm-hmm. that was on the case. She mm-hmm. talks about this. There's a four-parter. The episodes are about 20 minutes long. Mm-hmm. It also has one of the police that helped with the case mm-hmm. and they talk about it.
Oh, good.
And they had also mentioned that Hirschfield had molested the son of a girlfriend.
He's done so much more.
And it went on for years and said that this boy's life is basically ruined now. He's now on heroin and the boy's still alive. Well, mm-hmm. he's a man now, but his life is completely ruined.
Mm-hmm. It always does. But
so he has done more than no one has ever
When people say that,
thought.
You know, murder, well, they just molested them or whatever. It's a slow murder. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. Your life is ruined. It's mm-hmm. changed you. It's terrible.
I couldn't imagine. Couldn't imagine. All right, we have my daughter Hadley down here. She's gonna draw out 10
Hadley
names.
Is playing the role of Vanna White this evening.
Yay, all right, my little Carol Merrill. All right, you want to draw out 10 names?
Dig him in there, girl. Dig in there, girl. Come on, make it a winner. Make it a winner.
All right, so Hadley.
Dun da da da. Drum roll, please.
Who's the first one? From Twitter, Banana Booty.
Banana Booty.
You win a shirt.
Oh, okay. Okay. Let's see here. Woo, Miss Megan Miller.
Woo, Megan Miller.
Megan.
Next one. From Twitter, Eat Life.
Eat Life.
Yeah.
And I.
No, Eat Life.
Kidding. Eat Life. Okay,
let me
get one. It is Abigail Stevens.
Woohoo, Abigail.
Woohoo!
Next one.
You gotta cut that woo out of there. It's loud.
From Twitter, Corey.
Corey! Corey's from St. Louis.
Corey
right?
is from St. Louis, I believe, yeah.
Hi, Corey.
Hi, Corey.
Congratulations, Corey.
I believe Corey's a new listener, too.
Well, I hope so.
So is Eat Life.
Yay.
Matter of fact,
new listeners sporting a brand new shirt.
I know.
All right, here we go. Ready?
Uh-huh.
Aaron Sullins. Atsby?
Is this from Twitter or?
It doesn't say.
Oh, then it's from our website. Okay. Facebook.
Oh, yay. Yeah. Facebook. Yay. Facebook.
Okay, the next one. Mary Hammer.
Mary Hammer.
Mary, if I had a hammer, I'd wear my OTCP shirt.
I'd drink it in a mug. I'm sorry. This one is from Twitter. That's what the
mm-hmm.
T means,
the
right?
T. Mm-hmm. T for Twitter.
Justice. Is Blonde.
Woo-hoo. Justice and Blonde, yay!
That's I just got the play on the name on there. That's
yeah,
very cute.
Uh-huh.
Justice is Blonde. Blonde.
She's
I like
got a
it.
Cute puppy and
cute.
Kitty, and okay. they always snuggle together. It's really cute.
How many are we up to?
Another podcast. Nikki Needs an Adult.
Nikki does
Actually,
need
I remember
an adult.
Hers. Hers was really funny. Hers was something about, is this the auditions from Jane's Addiction's Been Caught Stealing video?
With
that
the
was very
chat.
Funny.
That's
yeah.
cute. And I have the final one, and this one is from Twitter. Sandra Grout.
Sandra Grout.
Yay!
Woo, Sandra Grout. All right.
So is that it? That's 10?
That's it. That's 10. Here, you want to give me those so we can,
here.
I can post them on our Twitter and stuff.
I here. I kind of throw them
yeah.
back
Hadley,
in
you want
thing.
To talk?
I threw them back in the
Here,
thing.
Will you get
Minus
the,
this one.
Will you find those winners?
I don't
winners?
Remember who else it was. Mary
right.
Hammer.
Mary. No, Mary Hammer. I am.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Well, right. We'll figure it out. All right, congratulations, guys.
Dumb and Dumber try to run a contest.
Please, please. Exactly. Please, please, please. We need your size t-shirt so we can order them. And the color. There's navy, there's black, there's white, and gray mm-hmm. that you can order from. I think they're men's t-shirts, so they run anywhere from, I want to say, I don't know if there's extra small.
To 3X, 3 extra large.
3X, but if we need a larger size, I think it goes up to 4X.
Oh, okay.
We can get them in 4X.
Okay.
And if actually you need a larger size than that, email me and we'll see what we can do. But yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
that's
exciting. That was fun.
That was
and
fun.
And so what about our name contest that you got going on?
Name contest that we will figure that one out later. That one doesn't end until Friday.
Friday. Okay.
Because I had ADD.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right,
OTCP
well,
gets
good.
ADD.
That's yep. right. OMG.
OMG. Anyway, so yeah.
All right. Well, I guess tell the people how they can.
You can find us on Facebook. We have our own Facebook page, mm-hmm. which I think we're going to put that private.
Mm,
okay. So you're going to have to ask for permission, but I'll give you a secret.
Like a private group. I like that.
Everybody's accepted.
Everybody
yeah.
is. I mean,
it's a, yeah. So let's see. ASMR. You can also find us on our blog, ourtruecrimepodcast.com. You can also listen to us on our blog also. You can find us at Twitter, or you can find us on Twitter with at our true crime pod, or at OTCP-cam.
I think it's wrong. I think we had that wrong the last time it was when I checked, but I don't remember what it is.
I think it's OTCP-cam.
What, maybe?
Yeah. Let me look real quick.
You don't need to.
Yeah, I do. Mm-mm. You don't want people talking to you?
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it does. You don't want to get those people that give you full diapers thinking I'm so...
No, thank you. That is really gross.
Oh, it's at OTCP with Cam. See, that's right.
That's what I said. Yeah.
And you can download any of our episodes anywhere you have... Anywhere you listen to your podcasts, we're on all the podcatchers. And if you want to go to iTunes and rate us, that's great. But please only leave constructive criticism. If you just tell us that our sound's bad or that we sound high, or
you don't like two hosts when it says
when
explicitly
there's three. Yeah.
That there's two friends that talk about crime. Anyway, that's it.
Anyway.
We love you all.
Everybody's we'll keep it short got the right. So anyway.
Remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya. See, I always say exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
I say right.
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 Exactly.
Exactly.
See, I mean, there
right?
you go, right?
Right.
And to tell you the truth, we had so many people.
Today.
Well, Valentine's Day is tomorrow. And
Thursday. Valentine's Day is Thursday.
Right, but this goes out on...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, yeah. Okay. Sorry, let's go back. Sorry.
Just did some kind of ligature. Had them a liquor...
Licorice?
Some kind of... there was a reddish mark that suggested some sort of ligature.
You tripped on suggested.
I know.
Okay.
I'm just tripping.
Ligature. Ligature.
Tripping.
He's tripping. Dog.
Came there with a sharp knife or some other weapon, and he brought some duct tape. Mm-hmm. And he had the duct taped. Fuck me.
And okay.
Cooperating.
They'd start talking to each other?
They'd talk, exactly. So.
Could it sound weird?
Camille, did you fart?